talked to them, they are housed.
So, right, so I've got that, okay.
Yep.
If you can maybe follow up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Eric, are we recording yet?
Yes, ready to go.
Good morning. Needless to say, I have white hair and I'm not bald, so I'm not Nick Holland. So. Nick is under the weather this morning. He may be joining us by Zoom, but he's asked me to sit in to sort of kick things off. First, let me say thank you to everyone who's here today. I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation, to continue these conversations. I was sharing with Dietrich Connor over the Nonprofit Center yesterday. I was at the Scenic Jacksonville event last night. A lot of great conversation there. How pleased I have been at the progress of each of these meetings, the engagement of the chairs, the co-chairs, the work that they've done. Dawn and her counterparts have really jumped in with both feet, and I thank them for that. But it wouldn't be effective, it wouldn't be as important if all of you weren't in the room at the same time. So I do appreciate you being here and sharing your thoughts. So the predominance of this meeting is going to be a couple of presentations. Hopefully you have a copy of the agenda. But before we go through that, I do want to go around the dais here to recognize who's at the table. Yeah, there's a switch on the back you've got to turn on. And then hit the button so it turns green. There you go.
Matamron Bacon, Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Noel Combo, Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Amber Lehman, Executive Council Assistant for Nick Holland.
Michael Boylan, District 6, and Chair of the Committee.
Don Gilman, CEO, Changing Homelessness.
Harrison Conyers, Supervisor of Military Affairs and Veterans Department, City of Jacksonville.
Ron Salem, Group 2 at Large, Vice Chair of the Committee.
And I'd also, again, want to recognize and thank the Northeast Florida Regional Council. They have been instrumental in helping us in the organization of this, and I had a great conversation with Beth Payne yesterday. She and I will be meeting this afternoon, as a matter of fact, and then the committee chairs and co-chairs will be meeting next Thursday to talk about the last two meetings as to how we want to, quote-unquote, land this plane. It's very important to me that we come out of these sessions with bona fide recommendations that will be moved forward for consideration not only by the existing administration and council, but by future administration and council. As many as you know, we have an election in the spring, and I am hopeful that candidates for the respective offices will use the roadmap that we are going to provide them and let us know where they stand on the positions of supporting these three critical community issues. And with that, I'm going to turn the floor over to our co-chair, Don Gilman.
All right. Thank you so much. Just to give a brief outline of how this meeting is going to go, I'm going to be joined via Zoom by one of my colleagues, K.O. Campbell from Community Solutions. What we're going to do in the presentation is I'm going to go over just a brief overview of what was presented last week. And it was just last week, by Dr. Joe Savage. Just kind of, I want to point out some of the commonalities. KO is going to go over the actual Jacksonville system of care, specifically on what have we been doing for veterans and veteran homelessness, and what does that work like? How could it translate to the broader population? At the end of that presentation, I know some of you have been asking me for what would numbers look like, what would change look like. I have that. One of the things I do is budgeting and numbers of how many people, that sort of thing. So I am going to put that out for everyone to take a look at. What would it cost to house a certain group of folks? And what does it actually cost our community to walk by those people? So everyone will get a chance to look at that. We are going to have another presentation from Harrison Conyers, who's going to focus on City of Jacksonville and their work specifically on veterans. At the end of his presentation, we will have time for discussion as well. If there's any public comment cards, we'll also have time for that. So I kind of set it up this way, and how we've run these meetings is there's already a system out there, right, that works to try to reduce and end homelessness. My understanding of this work is as a community, what would we want to change? What would we want to improve? What would it take to get to where we want to go? Which brings me to my question I keep asking every meeting, what's our goal, right? What's our goal that we wish to achieve, and what's our roadmap to get there? So many of you, I'm recognizing faces, have been to most or all of these meetings. So think about that. What would we change to get better outcomes? And for at least as I look at it, a better outcome is people are housed, there are fewer people living on our streets, or no people living on our streets. Everyone has a place, safe place to go at night. So with that, I am going, I see KO is up, and Nick has also joined us. Councilperson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Gilman. I really appreciate you acknowledging that. And I'm very apologetic that I'm not there. I'm, as Amber might have told everybody, I'm running a slight fever. I think it's just one of those 24-hour things, tested negative for COVID, thankfully. But I didn't want to get you all sick. So, Dawn, thank you for taking over. And Councilman Boylan, thanks for launching the meeting for me. I appreciate you stepping in.
All right, and KO, if you could share your screen yes. for the presentation.
Are you all able to hear me?
Yes.
Great. All right. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can.
Right, and we've just done this piece. Hi, everyone. I'm KO Campbell. I am a senior strategy lead on Built for Zero, and I know last week you had a chance to hear from Joe Savage. I feel really grateful to be following that presentation. Before I get into Jacksonville's progress, I do want to just give a little bit of an overview about what Built for Zero is, especially since you've heard about the U.S. Interagency Council and the federal criteria and benchmarks. Built for Zero is a little bit different because it is an initiative that teams voluntarily participate in. You are not required to participate in Built for Zero. About a third of the COCs in the country participate. And essentially, by participating, community teams have said, we are interested in working both with Built for Zero supports and also with a series of other communities across the country to figure out how to end homelessness more quickly. And I won't dwell here long, but a thing I do want to call out is that Community Solutions, which is the organization that is behind Built for Zero, has been doing work in resolving homelessness since 1990. In the 90s, it was primarily about acquiring permanent supportive housing, and then we started shifting into like how to help community teams house people more quickly, because most of our work in the 90s was based in New York, where we could acquire buildings and resolve street homelessness much more quickly. And it wasn't really scalable in the way that we were hoping for. Another thing I want to call out is that the Jacksonville team has actually been working with Community Solutions since 2010, before Built for Zero even existed. They participated in, or you participated in, an initiative called the 100,000 Homes Campaign. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second because it's pretty key. But we've been working with the Jacksonville team for quite some time now. Just wanted to give like a little bit of a background there. Won't dwell here long. There are about 100 communities participating in Built for Zero. There have been about 150,000 people at this point housed since 2015 through the Built for Zero effort. 14 of the communities have ended homelessness for some population, either chronic or veterans. That is a much smaller number than the number you heard about for criteria and benchmarks last week, and we'll talk about why in a little bit. The big number I want to call out here is this 62 on the right-hand side of the screen. That's the number of communities that have achieved and are reporting quality real-time data. And of those 62, 44 of them are driving measurable month-over-month reductions. Really, the grounding question for Built for Zero, the reason we do this work and what we're constantly coming back to is, are all of our programs and investments adding up to the thing we really want? And the way we've defined that is equitable reductions in homelessness over time. And if they're not, how quickly can we know and pivot? The first piece of that, in order to be able to answer that question and kind of live into that, the first piece of that methodology is actually having a clear end state. So what do we mean by ending homelessness? And there are two separate definitions, and these I will call out are different than the definitions you heard from the USICH conversation last week. They, while they're different, they are very, very simpatico. There's a better word for it. They fit together quite well. They're not in competition. They just measure differently. The Federal Criterion Benchmarks definition looks specifically at what your system can do. And the functional zero definition is about how many people are still experiencing homelessness. So for veterans, the definition states that you will have achieved functional zero when there are no more veterans experiencing homelessness than can be housed in an average month. And that is based on the community's specific housing placement rate. So right now in Jacksonville for veterans, that number is, I think, about 16, which means that until there are no more than 16 veterans experiencing homelessness, Jacksonville will not have hit functional zero. And we have this because this is one of the data pieces that gets submitted on a monthly basis to Built for Zero. For chronic homelessness, it's a little different, and this aligns perfectly with a federal definition. It's just 0.1% of all homeless individuals, according to your PIC count, or three people, whichever is greater. And for most communities, that means you cannot have more than three people experiencing chronic homelessness. And then once we've got that information, all of the work we do with community teams is about driving that number down. So instead of saying, these are the things your system needs to be able to do, we say, when you have extremely few people experiencing homelessness, so few that you could reasonably rehouse them in a single month, that's when you will have ended it. And the reason we do that is that the initiative we ran before, of which Jacksonville was a part, was called the 100,000 Homes Campaign. And in that campaign, we were looking primarily at increasing housing placement rates. We wanted to see community teams housing more people month over month. And we said, once we get to 100,000, that will represent essentially a tipping point, right? There were about 300,000 people experiencing chronic homelessness at the time. We figured if 100,000 of them get housed, then, you know, it will be such a massive dent that we will necessarily be on our way to ending chronic homelessness. And community teams worked really hard. What you see in this vertical axis here is the percent increase month over month that they were achieving. So teams actually were increasing the number of people they were moving into housing, and they did a great job. They housed 105,000 chronically homeless individuals, and we got to the end of that movement and realized that even though we had hit this big ambitious goal, we had not seen the corresponding decline in homelessness that we had expected to see. We've been focused too much on outputs and not enough on the actual outcome we wanted to see. So when we launched Built for Zero, the movement shifted pretty significantly. And instead of counting housing placements up to a master total, we wanted each individual community to be driving their active homeless numbers down. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, what we're trying to see is homelessness go down, not necessarily housing placements go up. It seems really straightforward in hindsight, but it was a really massive revelation in 2014, 2015. And so the way that works, there are two core components to being able to do that work. The first is actually getting good data. And we spent a lot of time working with community teams to actually build out those data sets. And I'll be talking a little bit about Jacksonville's data set specifically. And the second piece is about, once you've got that good data, how do you use it and what it tells you to figure out where you need to be improving your system. And I think a thing that's pretty relevant for this conversation is, where do you need to be injecting more resources into your system? What parts are functioning perfectly well? What parts really need to be addressed or enhanced? This slide looks a little overwhelming, but there are 7 data points that each community that participates in Built for Zero is asked to submit to us on a monthly basis. The first is the number of people actively experiencing homelessness. So on the 15th, what is that? Well, it will be Saturday. So Monday of next week, Eden at Changing Homelessness will log in and share with us the total number of veterans who are experiencing homelessness as of September 30th. So there are a couple of weeks to kind of make sure your data is all in alignment. And we will know that as of September 30th, there were 204 veterans experiencing homelessness in Jacksonville. He'll then share with us the number of veterans who actually left the system throughout the month of September, how many people these green are represented or represent the people moving into housing. So like who moved in through SSVF's rapid rehousing program, who moved in with a HUD-VASH voucher. The light blue, this can be kind of hard to distinguish, but the light blue are the number of people who were in our system and we've been looking for them for 90 days and haven't been able to find them. So we have good reason to believe that they either resolved their homelessness on their own, they moved in with friends and family, they left the city, they're somewhere else. We've looked for them, they're not there. So we're going to take them off our list because we've looked for them for 3 months and haven't been able to find them. And this last category is about veterans who no longer meet population criteria. This is something the Jacksonville team hasn't used in a very long time because they're quite good at verifying veteran status on the front end. But for communities that wait later to verify veteran status, we have a category in case people they originally thought were veterans turn out not to be veterans. So we have a way of making sure the, you know, for lack of a better term, the account balances, that their withdrawals and deposits sync up to their actual account balance. And then the last set of data points that they're entering are what veterans are coming into the system and what is their experience of homelessness so far. So we're able to see who are the veterans who are experiencing homelessness for the first time ever. Who are the veterans who we have moved into housing before but have come back? And who are the veterans who had self-resolved or had left but are now back in our system? And we look at this, and I'll talk specifically about this with Jacksonville in a minute, but it's important to have all of these data points for a number of reasons. One, again, we want to make sure those numbers balance. And in the beginning, they never do when we work with teams. It takes a minute to figure out, like, if your numbers don't sync up month over month, it tends to mean that there's either some kind of data entry challenge happening or that there's a program that's only participating on one side of the equation. But it really helps teams be able to see where there are gaps or where there are holes in their overall system flow. The second is so that you respond to the right type of problem. Preventing someone from becoming homelessness when it's their first time, those are really fundamentally different strategies than people who have been housed in your programs, right? The people who've been housed in your programs have existing case management staff who can be reaching out to them. You know exactly where they are. You have contact information for them. We are able to check in on people in different ways when they're returning than the strategies we would need to implement for people who are becoming homeless for the first time. Before I go on, are there questions about these data points?
I am not seeing any hands.
Okay.
Unless there's just, Jimmy, if you can tell me if there's anyone behind the pillar. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No questions?
No questions at this time.
Great. And then the meat of what we do, I'm actually going to skip this slide. It's a little too detailed. But the meat of what we do is actually then use the data for a local team. This is about Chattanooga's data. This is not Jacksonville data. I'll get into Jacksonville data in a minute. But what we are able to see, it seems a little overwhelming. But what you see on the screen is exactly what I was just pointing to, right? So the blue bars are the number of people leaving the system. The purple bars are the number of people entering the system. You get a little red box anytime there are more people coming in than going out. And if you hover over it, you can see what the breakdown is of the number of people coming in. So how many people are coming back that you've already housed before? How many people are brand new to the system? And you're able to make decisions there based on exactly where you think the improvement needs to be made. Down here at the bottom, you're also able to see, is our overall inflow increasing? Is it decreasing? So you're able to measure the success of your efforts against your own progress and your own historical capabilities. And I will say the team in Jacksonville has been able to look at this information and say one of the very specific instances within the veteran system, they noticed that they had a lot of people coming back into the system who had been housed by the system before, and they came up with a couple of different strategies. First, they were able to zero in and see who are most likely to come through the system multiple times. And when someone who meets those criteria enters the system for the first time, we actually have a different type of support we wrap around them to make sure that this time is actually their last time. The second thing they were able to do is go back through and look at their historical data to see when are people who get moved into housing most likely to fall out, and can we have teams reach out specifically a month or a few months, depending on when it was, in advance of that fallout time to make sure that if there are things they need from us, that we're able to get those resources to them before it is an emergency, because it is much, much easier to keep people in housing than it is for them to have to come back, stay in a shelter, find new housing. So if it is possible to keep people housed, we want to be able to be doing that work instead of the work of rehousing. And then ultimately, this is the active homeless number. So this is showing like what your data looks like over time. And just like that original slide I showed with the orange bars, we're looking to see active homeless numbers go down over time. In Jacksonville, I've got a couple of slides just so you can see some of the data that they're able to pull about their veteran system on a regular basis. And I will just caveat that I spend the majority of my time working with the veteran system. So this speaks to what that specific system can do. This is a look at their active homeless number over since January of 2020. We were on a pretty good track of driving reductions down. And as soon as the pandemic hit, we started to see it flatline out. This is pretty common across the country right now. And like it is held pretty consistently between 150 and about 210 since 2020. So the team right now is really working to start driving this number down. We've got some exciting opportunities on the horizon, but this is a pattern that a lot of community teams have seen with all the changes that happened during COVID-19. This is a quick snapshot of like who is actually experiencing homelessness as veterans. There are currently 204 veterans on the VNL. That's the by name list. So each of these individuals, we have like not just like information about when they came into the system, but information about what they're eligible for. So we're making the best possible use of the resources that the community has. We know who is the best fit for what type of program, who we need to be treating in what specific types of ways. You can see like how many of them are in emergency shelter, how many of them are working in EHA, how many are in transitional housing. And then these lists tell you where in the system they are. So these 122 veterans have not yet been matched to a housing resource. So, and then 46 of them are being worked with VA Outreach, 35 of them are working with the SSVF team, 41 of them don't yet have an enrollment. They're not yet matched to an outreach worker. And then the other 82 of the 204, these are the housing resources they're matched to. So 41 of them are on track to be housed using SSVF rapid rehousing dollars. 31 of them are currently matched to HUD-VASH vouchers, which are veteran-specific Section 8 vouchers. And 10 of them are actually working on both programs. So,
KO, we had another acronym request, SSVF.
Oh.
Supportive Services for Veteran Families, that is a rapid rehousing program, and HUD-VASH. I forget what all those acronyms, but that is
housing and urban development.
Thank you.
Yeah, like Veterans Administration supportive housing. So HUD-VASH are Section 8 like permanent supportive housing vouchers that are specific to veterans. The voucher is paid for by HUD, and the VA provides the supportive services.
Pamela, just for clarification, does this mean that there are 204 veterans out on the street right now, according to your count?
It does not mean that. That I'm really glad you asked that question. It does not mean that. It means that there are 204 veterans across the system. So some of them are in emergency housing, some are in emergency shelter, some are in transitional housing. And if you give me 5 minutes, I could tell you how many are unsheltered right now, but it is not 204.
Okay.
Yeah. Very good question. Thank you for asking that.
Any other questions before we move on? And if we do any acronyms that don't make sense,
yeah,
please just raise your hand and we will stop. And yes.
Yeah. What kind of support do you guys do aside from just the housing?
That is also an excellent question. So, both HUD-VASH and SSVF are a housing first model, which means there is no one gets disqualified for not accepting services. And we understand for someone to remain stably housed, we have to wrap those services around them that we need. So in both, I wouldn't say in both. In the HUD-VASH program, every veteran who is eligible for that program is also VA medically eligible, meaning they're eligible for all of the VA medical services. Their case management actually comes from the VA. For SSVF, we're also going to connect them with and wrap around any services they might need. In that program, it's really one of the most generous ones we have. We can provide everything from legal services, child care services. They will even let us do some minor car repairs. In addition to being really housing focused, meaning what do you need to stay in this? If housing is important to you, what do you need from us or other community resources to make sure that you can maintain that housing? So, one of the big things in that SSVF program is also a housing stability plan, right? There's a limited number of months in SSVF that we can pay for the housing supports. So the whole time we're doing that, we're working with the family, the household, to make sure when that support ends, they go on and are fine without us afterwards. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess so.
I do also... Oh, sorry. Is there another question in the room?
Yes, there is. There's literally a list of things that we can provide under SSVF. It is a little bit different than a lot of other programs, and I'm happy to give that to you. It's set up knowing that there's a wide array of things different households could or would need, but not every household needs everything. So it's trying to connect that particular household with what they need to ensure their stability.
Dawn, would substance abuse treatment and job placement, workforce development be part of those services offered under SSVF?
Yes. So some of those are going to be us connecting to other resources. Harrison is sitting next to me. So HVRP is one of the work resources available that we would connect people to. Also, substance abuse, mental health, while we don't have people on our staff that provide that, we connect the veteran with those community resources or VA resources they are eligible to.
Okay, and now a million-dollar question, because I'm sure the Affordable Housing Subcommittee is going to be concerned about this. Is it getting harder for you to keep people in housing given kind of the rising lease rates and housing costs? Because if you have a 3-month voucher, you know, that end of that 3 month, it's looking, you know, exceedingly difficult to stay in housing, I'm sure.
So it is not just rapid rehousing, it's also those permanent vouchers that are incredibly difficult. Prior to COVID-19, we actually track the average length of time from when a person is connected with a housing resource to when they move into housing. I think KO's putting that up on the screen right now. Prior to COVID-19, for veterans, we had that down to 33, 34 days. It's doubled to tripled, right? And that's regardless of whether it is a rapid rehousing shorter-term voucher or a permanent HUD-VASH voucher. I will be going to the affordable housing meetings also to just emphasize that deeply affordable housing is a critical piece of the broad-scale affordable housing within our community.
We've got a microphone up here so we can capture your questions. Go ahead, yep. Sir.
Yes, I have a three-pronged question. My first question is dealing with Chattanooga. I want to understand, is there information that's associated, like, the dollar amount? Like, if it's $6 million coming down from the federal level from either VA and also coming down from HUD, how many people does those dollars help? That's number one. And number two, how much money are we getting from the federal government, VA, and HUD each year that focuses on the same group of people, and how many are there? Because there's a cap to everything. And number three for me is, what is it that Chattanooga's learning that we could use here? Because it seems like there's some similarities between Chattanooga and us, and they're a little bit more ahead in trying to fix that problem. So,
Number one, I would say we in Chattanooga are doing incredibly similar things. Some of that is just the size of the community and what their individual housing market is. But let me answer those first two questions for you first, because I'm actually... You've jumped ahead of what I was going to do later, but I'm happy to do that now. So money from HUD that helps people directly. So if you go on our website, you can actually see the community application we just put in. It is an annual application. It is for $6.8 million of renewal grants, and we have put in, I think it's $700,000 or $800,000 for new money.
I'm sorry. When you say our website, you mean the
The Changing Homelessness website, which is cleverly changinglyhomelessness.org. And the people that you asked for, so the renewal amount is $6.8 million. Those are grants that already exist. We're asking for that money to be renewed to us again. That is a total of 262 permanent supportive housing units. So it could be some units have more than one person in, depending on the household configuration. And it funds about 100 at the time we submitted it, we had 123 units of rapid rehousing. So those are people that are actually living in those units. Now, the thing to remember on those two is permanent supportive housing. You're standing in front of Shannon Nasworth, who's one of our largest providers of that. If we have an opening in permanent supportive housing in this community, our community providers are incredibly good with assisting people in staying in that unit.
Oh, Ms. Gilman, I'm sorry if I'm jumping ahead, but where do we get to a point where we have universal housing vouchers? How do we get a strong partnership for something like that?
Okay, that is an excellent question. If you remember in the very first meeting, someone asked the question, why is there such a long wait for the Section 8 vouchers? That's the closest we have right now. The answer there is the amount of funding that is provided for those vouchers. Only 25% of the people who qualify for a permanent voucher, whether permanent supportive or just a permanent voucher, will ever get it. It is not a lack of ability. It's a lack of funding for the actual housing. So, like I said, if we can get the vouchers, and I'm actually going to give you some numbers, I promise, at the once we're done with this, on what would it cost, what is the actual money that it would cost to house a certain population with those wraparound services, right? Because you can't just move somebody in if they've had some challenges before and expect them to immediately be okay. There's but, some, yeah.
Yeah, but Ms. Gilman, I see somebody from JTA, and JTA has a TOD. When they purchase land, they have to build it. There was a piece of legislation that was pulled from the city council, and then you have JIA that has property too. The only organization that's in this room right now is JTA. Why don't we have JIA, which owns property? I don't know that if some of their property could be zoned, rezoned out there in their corridor, and I don't know.
So let me, I'm going to jump to this because it's, when, if you, I believe the type of housing you're talking about is for it to be able to move folks directly off the street into housing, correct? Okay. So when we talk about that type of housing, you are built, you have to have incentives with it. There is no private developer that can pencil a project out, meaning they are required to make a certain level of money from any project they do for deeply affordable housing. So when we, not me personally, when the community, when a community partner puts a package together, and I'm going to let Shannon correct me if I'm wrong, there's usually between 4 and 8 different funding streams to make it all work. So it is not, I would like it to be as straightforward as JTA has land and there is funding immediately available for 100% coverage to build that project, and we would have another funding stream that would be able to immediately provide those supportive services. At the next meeting, I have asked my colleague from Atlanta to come because they have put together different types of funding to be able to move the needle. Right? Like not 100%, but move that needle. And how do you put that kind of complex package together for a city?
If we could, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I appreciate that. And we are going to have this conversation. We want to get through the presentations for today. I'm going to ask a question of my own, actually, for the folks in the audience. And you don't care, you don't need to raise your hand if you don't care to. But do we have any veterans in the audience today who consider themselves homeless by show of hands? Thank you.
All right, KO, I think we are ready for you to move on.
Well, what I pulled up while you were talking, Don, I think it was in response to one of the questions, is has the rising cost of housing impacted, or how has it impacted? And what I've pulled up here is just the current length of time it takes from when someone gets a voucher or rapid rehousing assistance in hand to the time it takes them to move in. And over the past 3 years, Don, you basically called it exactly. Like in 2019, it was in the like close to 30. And today the average is 106 days. So it's like more than 3 months from the time someone literally has the money they need to pay for a voucher. And I think in September, the number was closer to 200. It's almost like 180 days, which is a significant, that's 6 times the length of time it was taking before. It's taking much, much longer. Not even, that isn't even the homelessness response system. That's actually just the amount of time it takes to move people into housing in Jacksonville right now for veterans. There are a couple of other pieces. You can see this is similar information for 2020, 2021, 2022. This is the number of veterans being moved into housing month over month. Just as you would expect, this, we are seeing the opposite trend. We're seeing those numbers decline. In response, a couple of VA programs have essentially expanded access. So the HUDVASH program has opened up its enrollment criteria. So there are new discharge statuses that are now eligible for HUDVASH vouchers, which is pretty exciting. And the rapid rehousing program, I know Don started talking about what they're able to do, but in response to this trend, which they're seeing across the country, they have become incredibly flexible. They've just put out a new round of funding that can pay for a huge number of things, ranging from client incentives to landlord incentives, housing navigation services, as long as the money directly results in a veteran moving into housing. So there are very responsive funding streams right now, and we expect some of these numbers to change. You know, I think, I don't know, Don, exactly when you got the money, but I think it was like October 2nd or something. I think we do expect to see these numbers change a little bit because there is extremely responsive funding for the veteran system. And it is worth acknowledging that the veteran system right now is very well resourced, and the resourcing can pay for lots of different types of things, which as we go into the discussion, I think it's probably worth considering, like, where, like, if we are as a community trying to make the most out of our investment, like, where do we need to be putting money specifically in order to see the type of change we want to see? And I'm just going to pause for questions on this, and then otherwise I'll pass it back to Don for the discussion portion.
All right. I am not seeing any questions right now. And first of all, thank you everyone who asked the questions and KO's presentation, because you kind of set up exactly what I want to talk about now. For those of you who were here last week, Dr. Savage talked about four different programs. And I'm going to just point out some, I'm going to remind you of all four and then point out the commonalities. The first one was Philly Cares. That was a business community initiative, and they were focused on housing persons who met the definition of chronically homeless who are living on the street. So they are currently in the process of raising funding for that. They want to fund supportive housing that is very low barrier, and they are looking to raise $500,000, and they have another $500,000 pledge specifically from the Philly Tourism, whatever their equivalent of Jacksonville Tourism is in Philadelphia. The second one was in Orlando, housing the first 100. Again, this was an initiative focused on 100 chronically homeless people who were specifically the most medically vulnerable. This was an initiative that was funded and championed by the large hospital and medical systems in Orlando. The third one was Moore Place in Mecklenburg County, which is right outside of Charlotte. It's a suburb of Charlotte. It's building permanent supportive housing units for persons living on the street who are chronically homeless. And the fourth one was Indiana on the PSH, which is Permanent Supportive Housing Initiative, specifically for, chronically homeless people who were currently living on the streets. So all four are focused on, when we look at the system, people that we feel are the most vulnerable are at the top of what KO talked about, our by-name list. We have a by-name list for everyone we know who is experiencing homelessness. All four of the programs, three out of the four programs, are currently active and in existence. All three have shown significant community impact. So I took the co-chair's initiative and just imagined what our city council people might ask of me. So, Dawn, what would it take to make this kind of change in Jacksonville? So, we are big on data, as you may have noticed from that presentation from KO. So looking at our by name list, I know that there are at least 191 persons currently on our street who are over the age 55 and up and are chronically homeless. So what would it take to get them housed in 2 years and then provide the funding to keep them housed for 3 years after? 5-year program. This is something that that's my job to do for our community. So I actually put the numbers together. I actually have a budget. I will pass the budgets out, and I will give the PDF to Amber so she can send it out to everyone. First of all, we know from other initiatives that we have done, housing 191 folks does not happen overnight, especially in our current real estate market. There are not 191 available affordable units in Northeast Florida. So I kind of mapped it over 2 years, we were going to house 8 people a month over 2 years to get to our goal. That actually gives us one extra person, just in case anyone's doing the math on their phone as we do this. So I will pass this out, and I don't know if Noel, if you, okay, let me, there's two.
Dawn, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Is this an appropriate time?
Absolutely.
Turn your mic on there, Tom.
Okay. I'm sorry. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I had to step out, but the other job called.
Absolutely.
It would seem to me, at least in my experience, the more calls and places I get are homeless in the downtown area.
Yes. So I have been doing this. I have been doing this since I was pregnant with my first child, who is now a freshman in high school. So that kind of gives you, when I first started, downtown and the beaches were our two hotspots. For a while, the beaches kind of went down. Downtown was the biggest one. We have shifted back to where downtown is still our predominant location of persons experiencing homelessness. We are seeing an uptick at the beaches, but more in the intercoastal areas.
So my comment or question is that those are the calls when I'm out in the community, business people that work downtown. It's the homeless downtown that seems to get the most focus to me. So my question would be, and I wish Cindy was here, Cindy Funkhauser, but I don't see her. Is there availability within her shop to house more people?
No. I mean that's why I put this together. I would put forward and am happy to go through all of the data of all of the programs that we currently have within our system. All are operating at capacity. Some are operating above capacity. So if we want to see a change in homelessness, whether it's downtown, in the suburbs, anywhere within our county, we have to figure out how do we increase capacity. What I have put forward that's being passed out, and everyone will get a copy of if you're on the email distribution list, is from our data, the individuals that are most, that you get the most calls about are probably chronically homeless. The people that we are most concerned about from a medical vulnerability standpoint are 55 and up. Most of those people would be in the downtown area, but not all.
Can I make two other
Sure.
quick comments? I think you'd get a lot of business support from the business community that works downtown on that population. Lastly, the comment is, we've just approved the site for the new Sulzbacher on the north side, and I know she's building, I believe, 110 units. Councilmember Bowman,
yep.
Yes.
And I think that's several years away, so I don't think that's going to impact this, would be my comment.
Correct? And
okay.
What I want to make sure, and this is really towards City Council and everyone who doesn't work necessarily within our system every day. Right now, on our by name list, there are 3,400 individuals. There are 3,400 individuals that we know by name who are currently experiencing homelessness. We've just run through data specifically on veterans, and I would like to put out there, veterans who are experiencing homelessness have access to more resources than any other subpopulation that we work with. That is a function of the federal government and the VA funding programs specifically for homeless veterans. Changing Homelessness administers that supportive services for veteran families. We are required to spend a minimum of 60% of that on literally homeless individuals. We can only spend a maximum of 40% on people who are at risk of homelessness, so prevention services. That is their requirement. All of the new funding coming down is specifically for persons who are veterans and homeless. So a lot of the federal programs are very prescriptive. What I put out in that budget is if we want to house just under 200 chronically homeless individuals, the cost for that, for the housing, for the supportive services, for what it takes to run a program that large is about $3 million a year. I ran the numbers just based on round numbers, and you guys can, I'm happy to break it out and do whatever needs to be done, but once you get it fully full, all the people are in, it's going to cost about $3 million a year. As I mentioned, the agencies that do permanent supportive housing are really pretty good at it. There's less than a 10% turnover in a month in any of our permanent supportive housing units. So meaning if we add 190 units, we can expect in a year, maybe once it's full, we can add maybe another 15 to 20. Those will be the openings we will have. But I want to do one more thing before we take more questions, because if you went through all four of those different proposals, one of the Orlando one explicitly put a number out. What does it cost us not to house those 190-some people? And that's $30,000 a year on average. I think it's probably gone up, but that's the best one we have thus far. And they made more copies, and we'll pass those around. And I'll have Noel. Oh, can I keep one just so I know what I'm talking about? I appreciate that. So I used red and green on my copies. Green is good. So the cost over 5 years, so this is the full-in cost, 5 years, housing those folks that I talked about, is just over $13.5 million. The cost of doing nothing, and when I say doing nothing, that includes ER visits, that includes detox, that includes the sheriff's office, that includes crisis stabilization units, that includes the cost of going through emergency shelter, all of that is a cost to our community when someone is homeless. So that cost is just under $26 million. So if you, now the reason we don't usually look at it that way is, like I said, there's a half a dozen different buckets that those costs get distributed among versus looking at what is it costing Jacksonville, Florida to allow people to remain homeless on our streets. So for those of you who have been in my office, I actually do have a magic fairy wand that my staff gave me at one point. So if the funding fairy came, I would actually ask for the full $26 million. I would put that money in for the 190-some people to get them housed. And then I would advocate for that other $12 million for deeply affordable housing. Can we create a program for, if we're funding other affordable housing, can we buy down those rents to make it deeply affordable? can we provide the first money in or the last money out for those projects, right, to make it pencil out for a nonprofit, right? Because we want them to, if they're going to build it, we want them to be able to afford it and operate it for decades to come. But to your point, right now, if we do nothing, there are, we can, always are looking for additional funding at all levels for building, for rapid rehousing, for the services that go behind it. The reason I was able to put this budget together so quickly is I've actually shopped it around at both the federal and the state level before. So we know who is out there. The question is, what can we do differently to find the funding to get our most vulnerable citizens, people, neighbors, into housing? So with that, I'm going to take a deep breath, and I think there's, I'm sure Shannon's going to have something.
I might jump in very quickly, thank you very much, Dawn. This is exactly the kind of information we need to help us, and particularly the second number is probably more critical on understanding what the impact is now. One thing I don't see on here, obviously, it wouldn't apply to all the folks, but making them employable, training. Are the resources available in other, I know CRM and others I know do, Salvation other do training opportunities. Is that something the staffing people would coordinate in getting them into programs to get them employable?
Possibly. When you're talking about this population, so when I say chronically homeless, that is actually a very specific federal definition. It means everybody in this group has a diagnosed disability and they have been homeless for a minimum of a year. I also put the criteria on that they are 55 and older. So it is possible some of this group may be employed, may become employed again. Yes, if that is that person's desire, absolutely. We can connect them to a lot of different things. This group is probably the least likely to ever become fully employed, meaning having a 40-hour a week job, being able to completely support themselves. There are, when we talk about rapid rehousing, right, that other shorter term, again, the best description I ever got of that is think of it as an employment program that has a short-term housing subsidy,
sure,
meaning the whole purpose of rapid rehousing is to gain household income.
That's the ideal goal.
But again, when you look at, right, like when you say persons experiencing homelessness, out of that 3,400 people, that's a huge group,
right,
with lots of different circumstances that we get to know as we talk to them, but not all, everyone is the same. I would also remind everyone, when we talk about employment, $20 an hour is what you currently need to work 40 hours a week and be able to rent a market rate apartment. That also assumes you have no kids and no debt, which many of our folks who are housing insecure have children, have families, have debt.
Before I recognize Shannon, I do want to recognize Council President Freeman has joined us. Thank you, sir, for being here. Go ahead.
So, John, thank you for all the great information. For those who don't know, Shannon asked for affordability housing. We develop affordable housing at all of our properties. We set aside at least some of the units to provide permanent support housing for chronically homeless and or veterans. And we also master lease over 100 units in the Duval community to also provide permanent support housing for chronically homeless persons. We did a pilot a few years ago in partnership with the state for housing finance, OCDA, DCF, and others, work with the healthcare system, the continuum of care members, and the sheriff's office to identify our highest utilizers for chronically homeless individuals. And I can provide you summaries of the report. We were able to document for Duval County specifically that it was 30% less expensive for us, including the cost of the housing and services, to move chronically homeless individuals into permanent support housing. That is comparing the cost from the day they move in to 2 years before they move in to 2 years after. We had over 90% of the highest utilizers. I mean, we were turning people away because they weren't hard enough to serve this pilot. because we really wanted to focus on the hardest to serve, the people most vulnerable who will die on our streets the fastest, but we don't get them into housing. And even with that, we had over 90% retain their housing. Mm-hmm. We were also, I do want to say, though, with that, you know, I mentioned we develop housing, we also ask for lease other units. And supply is a major issue. We're having real problems maintaining landlords willing to continue to lease to us. While we may need $20 an hour to afford market rate housing, most of the individuals have families, have children, and they need, the rent is just more than that, and it seems to be going up every day. I heard, I guess it was last week, that we're expecting another 9% increase for year-over-year rent increases for Jacksonville, and that's on top of astronomical year-over-year rent increases for this year and the year prior. So we're just having real problems with landlords willing to maintain our programs. Not because they have problems with the residents, but because they can get more rent. Mm-hmm. And so it's supply is a major issue, and we just need to build more housing. And then if the city is putting any money into it, really work with the developers to target some of those units to homeless, but then also to work with providers so that some of those units are targeted to permanent support housing so that they're deeply affordable and have the providers that we need. I did also want to let you know that last year or earlier this year, Florida Housing Finance conducted a statewide needs assessment for affordable and supportive housing for special needs and homeless households. So they have Duval County specific numbers, if you want them, on the number of housing unit needs broken out by they just need affordable, and you're putting the word just, to those who also need wraparound supports to maintain their housing. Not just quantifying the need, but also putting dollar numbers as to what it would cost to create those housing units. So that resource is available if you guys are interested in it. And, you know, I just really encourage you to work with the Affordable Housing Committee because there's going to be so much overlap and the recommendations you guys should be presenting because homelessness, by definition, is a housing issue. You are not homeless if you have a home. So, you know, the recommendations they're providing, please really work closely with them. Homelessness is not solely about housing, but it is fundamentally about housing. And as the chair of the state's Council on Homelessness, we have repeatedly reminded the governor and legislature that the number one recommendation and need is more affordable housing.
Shan, I really appreciate those comments, and you're absolutely correct. We are working very diligently. These are all interconnected issues.
Yep.
And the working groups, although operating, you know, in silos in some respects, it's going to be our responsibility to pull these all together because they are all interrelated, as we've talked about. And the very conversation you just had, if you need to use, Carnell, if you want to use the microphone, come on up to the podium. But we're having that very conversation already in the attainable housing area to talk about how do we create the opportunity for workforce housing, you know, affordable housing units in some of the new developments that were coming down the pike. Thank you.
Ms. Gellman, you mentioned two areas that have my interest. One is state, one is the federal government. Where are some of the partners on the federal level that can make this make federal government close certain loopholes so that they can generate more revenue so that those dollars, more dollars can go towards HUD and they can have a specific purpose for like long-term care? And on the state level, what are some loopholes that you can close in the tax code on the state level that can generate more money to help accomplish this mission? The thing about it is that learning how government works, everything is a dollar. Every time you lose a dollar, you have more problems. And this is the problem that we're in right now. We need to make up that difference. To a certain extent, we may not be in the need of raising taxes. What we need to be doing is making everybody pay their fair share in taxes.
So, as I know you know, the budget is proposed at the federal and the state level. The holders of the purse strings of those budgets are elected officials. So if we, if individuals on the federal would like to see more money allocated towards HUD on the federal level, we do happen to have a local congressman who sits on the T-HUD bill, which is the committee that actually funds HUD. So letting John Rutherford's office know that this issue is important to you and you support full HUD funding is one way to do it. As far as changing tax loopholes or different things, that's where you get, like, there are always going to be winners and losers on that, right? So one of the things, especially in the when we look at, I think it was put out by the low-income housing, right? Right now there's tax credits available if you own a house on the interest that you pay on that. So if that money that people automatically get, right, like you don't have to qualify for it, you don't have to say what your certain income level, you don't have to do any of the things, you just get that, you can just claim that on your income taxes if you can prove the income. That tax credit is probably enough to fully fund what we would need to do affordable and deeply affordable housing, right? But there's a trade-off. That is a very popular thing for people who own houses. So is it more likely politically for us to advocate for just greater funding for HUD, right, for specific programs that maybe the Congress likes? Or is it better to spend political capital on changing a tax loophole? So that's, I have many thoughts on that, but I will happily talk to you about that at length. So there's not, again, kind of like that housing, there looks like there is maybe a straight road there. There's lots of different pushes and pulls on who's pulling those strings and how do we convince them that this is the right thing to do. I will say the federal government gives the most money, at least locally, for homeless and housing.
Okay, what about on the state level?
State level.
What we need to fix there on tax level.
Well, let me interject at that. We have an election coming up.
Yes.
In just a few weeks. Now is an excellent opportunity to reach out to candidates for the state legislature to let them know of your priorities and of your interest in this process,
yeah,
as well as the federal level. And as I mentioned, we started this conversation today. The municipal elections are in March, and that's why we are pushing ahead to try and get these recommendations done. So candidates will have to speak to the initiatives and recommendations coming out of this work. And Council President Freeman wanted to interject.
Thank you, Chairman Boylan, and my apologies for my tardiness. We had a ribbon cutting at the Sauce Bucket this morning on the solar, and just dovetailing on that question, because we understand government is so cumbersome, and there's just so many different lanes to get to it, as you said. But you mentioned the federal level, and in speaking with the Housing Authority, I believe they shared with me that pretty much all of their money that they're getting currently right now is coming through the federal level. One, 50 states. Do we know, where does Florida fall when it comes to the percentage of dollars that are coming from D.C. to our state? And if you don't have that answer, we can just get back offline.
Yep.
So I would love to know that number.
Yeah, I do not know that, but I can get that for you.
Gotcha.
I do know if you want to deeply reduce homelessness across the country, there's three states you have to go through, and that's Florida, Texas, and California. Those, we are all big states. Each of those states has multiple cities that are over 1 million people. Homelessness tends to be in an urban area. That does not mean that there's not rural homelessness, but that is where a lot of people who are experiencing homelessness live. The West Coast, I would put to all our elected officials,
Thank you.
The West Coast shows what happens when you have incredible increases and rents, and let it get ahead of the system, right? There's a lot of people in California who probably never thought they would ever experience homelessness who are because they can't afford the rent.
Right, and I just had one more follow-up, and we don't have to go deep into the weeds. I just wanted to get a better understanding of the process. So we have one member on that committee that's from our region.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure how many members are on it, but do we know the process when they're having their discussions, when we're talking about I don't like using this word, but we'll say advocating. I like that word better.
Yes.
When we're talking about advocating, as one member, can he make that much of a difference in that group, or does it take collectively trying to either partner with other states or with other leaders to get a collective consensus of trying to get more?
That committee is fairly small. If I'm remembering, 12 to 18 people. There you go. All right. She has the answers.
And
20 years.
Perfect.
So you're right. It's about, I think right now the split for T-HUD is 12. However, if you're looking at veterans housing, that's going to be in military construction and veterans subcommittee in the appropriations committee. So that's even in a different one. If you're looking for elder housing, that's under labor HHS, and so that's even under a different one. There's a lot of programs, and there's a lot of reasons why they're funded in different places. So if you're asking for funding in housing, look for specifically what you're asking. Pay attention to how you're asking and be open to a lot of different options.
I'm sorry. The co-chair is pushing me by a text. We need to get to Harrison quickly. I love this conversation, and I want to continue it, but I do, out of respect for Harrison's time, we'd like to get him to go ahead and make his presentation.
All right.
Yes. You can grab the microphone. No, it doesn't turn off. Yeah, you got to turn off that switch. Thank you. Pastor Barlow, we'll recognize you after.
Well, good morning. I wanted to follow up from the great presentation that Dr. Moreland gave us last time about some of the city's investments in homelessness and talk about a little bit about the boots on the ground that we've got here. We do have a program that is in partnership with a lot of our friends here in the room here today to really get us to that point. Let's make sure we're working here. All right, it's not working. You want to hear from me?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll just So that's just the tagline that we've got today for our commitment to ending homelessness. You go ahead and go to the next one. First, just to tell you a little bit about who we are. Jacksonville is one of two cities in the United States that has a military affairs and veterans department that actually reports to the mayor. There's a cabinet-level department that reports to the mayor. So that's very important. It gives us an ear. It gives us support to really make a difference in some of the areas we need to do. You see a couple of the areas that we focus on: veteran services, social services, outreach and advocacy. What that means, veteran services is typically connecting veterans with their earned benefits, whether it's health care, whether it's pension, whether it's disability, whatever that might be. Social services, we actually have active social services in our department. It is not taxpayer funded. It is funded through donations of the Jaguars Foundation and funds that we raise with military and veteran serving organizations within the community, and we have a trust fund. We do rent and utility assistance, food and clothing assistance, up to $500. So we're able to, a lot of times, deal with an issue that has come up that day. Someone's going to be evicted that day. Someone's going to have their electricity cut off that day. We're able to help out with them directly. And then the outreach and the advocacy, that's really how we deal with our military in Jacksonville. We've got 5 military bases here. We've got 50,000 active duty military or defense contractors. So we're actively engaged in working with the bases, actively engaged in advocating federally for more DOD investment in Jacksonville, more ships, planes, personnel to grow that investment in Jacksonville. Right now it's about $12.1 billion a year that we see here in Jacksonville. So go ahead and move to the next one, please. So a couple of the events we do, that's how we're known to the community with a lot of events we do. Purple Heart Observance, the Military Spouse Night Out, something we do for all our military spouses. Homeless Veterans Stand Down, you see Mayor Curry there providing a bicycle for one of our homeless vets. Go on to the next one, please. Memorial Day Observance, which is Jacksonville hosts the largest Memorial Day Observance in the country outside of Washington, D.C. You've seen the wall live. You've seen the wall down there on the west side of the stadium there. We're getting ready to start what we call Celebration of Valor. It used to have a Veterans Day Parade, then it was Week of Valor. Now it's Celebration of Valor because it goes from the end of October through the middle of December, and it's about 18 events that we sponsor to recognize our military and our veterans. And then the Veterans Day Parade. Jacksonville has the largest one in the southeast. Homeless Veterans Stand Down. A lot of you partner with us with that. Every January, typically, we rent the agricultural fairgrounds, and we have a 2-day event where we provide services to homeless veterans. The first day is career-focused. We do haircuts. We do resume assistance. We do interviewing skills. We do dress for success. We actually provide suits or dresses, whatever is needed that day. And then we have employers come in that are actually actively hiring veterans at the event that day. The second day is kind of our day of service, where we have all of our partners in there. We have mental health care, we have dental care, we have medical care, we provide clothing, we provide food, and we make the veterans go through each one of the stations with our partners to access care, or at least check in with each one of our partners before they're able to access the food and the clothing at the end. And that's kind of the end of the day. That's what a lot of them there for, is get to go through the free clothing line and such. But we make them access the services first. This year is going to be January 28th and 29th coming up. So who's eligible for our program? We've got a program called Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program in Jacksonville. We've had it for 15 years. It's been funded for 13 of those 15 years. For two of those years, I was taking a lot of Tums and a lot of aspirin to get us through. But who's eligible for it? Because there's a lot of confusion with it, and it's changed over the years, too. So veterans are at risk of being homeless within 60 days. So there is a pending eviction coming, okay? Or they're being forced to move out of where they're being sheltered now. They're eligible for the program. Veterans who identify as at risk but are not limited to low income, facing eviction, referred to a shelter, welfare or public assistance recipient, as well as those who have recently housed. And this is one area where the Department of Labor has changed their regulations that helps us work, especially with our housing partners, better. If they have been housed within the last 14 days or they've got a voucher within the last 90 days for housing, they can still sign up for our program. Also, veterans cannot have a bad conduct discharge, but if they have an honorable discharge or an other than dishonorable discharge, we can work with them for that program. We also work with incarcerated veterans. Okay, so we awarded our new grant in 2017. We maintained that grant 17, 18, 19. We're not funded 2021. And then 21, 22, we were funded. We were blessed in 2020 that the mayor provided funding to allow us to keep a portion of our staff together, so we were able to do some case management with it. And we're currently under a new 22, 23 grant that will go through 25. During performance period, July 1 of 17 to present, we enrolled 437 veterans in our program. Okay, all of our veterans were referred to Career Source in Northeast Florida for co-enrollment to take advantage of their services. Also, 100% of our veterans were referred out for housing placement through Changing Homelessness and the Community Resource Referral Center. Okay, next one, please. Support services. What do we provide for these folks, and how do we do this? So we align with our local housing assistance strategy to ensure rapid connection to housing. Like I said, I don't want to go through, read you this all this for you, but basically 100% of the veterans that come in are connected typically same day with our housing providers, and we work with them for that. We also work with SalesWalker to have access to employment assistance, career training, shelter, meals, last little classes, and other applicable services. We subcontract with SalesWalker for help in those areas, and they're a very valuable partner. We also work with Northeast Florida Women Veterans that refer a lot of women veterans to us. That is a growing population in Jacksonville. So they have been great for us. Their founder is a former Career Source staffer, has great knowledge of this population, and are great working with us. And then they provide support services too. Also, Sulzbacher has a women's village. The Sulzbacher Women's Village has been a great partner with us as we subcontract with them. We work with the Veterans Treatment Court. All of the folks that are coming through that court are working with us. We support them in what they do. And we work with the mentors that work with them and to try to find them employment and stabilize them in this community. So hopefully they don't recidivate in the system there. We give them the supports they need. Three Rivers Legal Services, up through COVID, was based out of our office, and we were able to connect veterans with them in our office. Now it's through Zoom or referral to their offices to get them the legal aid they need. Okay. Enrolled veterans receive job search assistance and life skills. So we're an employment-based program that partner with our housing partners in the community. So here's what they're receiving: job search assistance, life skills, money management training. We purchase work tools, uniforms. We pay for training, whether it's forklift training, security training, whatever the client needs to support them. And get them their driver's license or the special licensing they need to get the jobs they need. Since July 1 of 2017, we talked about 437 veterans have been enrolled. 333 veterans have been successfully placed into employment. Included in that number was 28 during the year we were not funded. So we did not have the training resources or the support services needed, and our staff were able, through case management, to placed 28 veterans in that down year. All the veterans that we've placed, $15.92 is the average earning. We know it's not $20, but it coming from zero, it's a very good wage. We follow them for 1 year after employment. We also follow up with the employers for 1 year after employment. And right now, we've got 100% that are maintaining employment after a year. Okay? So that equates to $33,000 a year that they're earning if they're working 40 hours a week. Some work a little bit less, especially in the security-type jobs. Warehousing jobs, they're working well over $40 an hour because, you know, Amazon's growing and it needs those folks. So we talked a little bit around our enrollment numbers. 437 over those years, 95% of our enrolled veterans completed vocational and technical training program that helped them in their jobs or helped them get a better job. We pay for that too for them. We referred every single one of the folks that enrolled in our program were referred for placement with transitional or permanent housing. Also of those, many were able to self-resolve after they got employed. So that helps with those numbers too. So they were either helped with housing through our partners, or some of them self-resolved and found their own housing after they were able to bring in some income there. 100% of the enrolled veterans were referred to the VA directly. We're blessed. We have an office right here in this building. In that office, we've got six basically paralegals that help them navigate the VA system, help them access the benefits they've earned, whether it's health care or whether it's disability rating, to help them bring in additional income. And there, 100% of those veterans were referred. And that's one thing when I talk to our partners about. Sometimes they tell us, well, this veteran's disabled. You know, I haven't referred him over for your employment program. I said, refer him to us anyway. Because even if we can't get him employed, we can get him with our folks in the office to get them a disability rating and get them income that helps them out. So we've got a lot of those wraparound services. Some aren't a fit for the program. Some aren't employable right now. And we've got social services, and we can help them that way, too. So we've really got a great center here in Jacksonville that's able to bring those wraparound services to need to get them back up on their feet. Okay, next one. I talked about the number that we've placed. We're very proud of that. Really what the employed veterans will be, they'll be filed for a year. This allows our staff to assist in maintaining or placing veterans not only in new jobs, but finding them better opportunities. So over that year, very often we're able to find that we initially place them in an initial job, we're able to get them a better job as they get their skills, as they get stabilized, as their housing gets stabilized, and their life gets stabilized, so their income is going up from there. For the program year 21-22, we had 100% placement rate for episodically homeless. That's the department's labor's term for chronically homeless. So very hard population, but 100% success rate in getting them placed in employment, okay? From 2017 forward, the rate is 91%. So being able to give them that case management is getting folks that have been chronically in the system, chronically on the streets, into jobs, self-supporting. And one thing that's really made me proud, I've had two of them use the exact same term as they've come back to talk to us after the fact, and said, you restored my dignity. Because now they're providing for themselves. And these are warriors. You know, these are warriors, and they're providing for themselves, and we've restored their dignity. So that gives us a boost to keep doing what we're doing. So, like I said, 95% vocational technical training. So that's a great skills for them. All enrolled veterans receive job search assistance. Career Source is based out of our office Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. So whatever we can't do, they're there to help them. So they're there for follow-up services, too, with the program. So we're that, and then we do a lot of job fairs. We've got a program in the department called Jobs for Vets with 500 public companies that are here in Jacksonville, or Jacksonville-based, or have presence in Jacksonville, that want to hire veterans. So we've got that program, too, and that helps us a lot, placing these veterans. So I talked about the Career Source being there, so that's great for us. We can help out. They help out with a lot of the other activities we do, like the standout. So services offered from this program, employment, referrals to partner agencies, whether it's housing, whether it's VA, case management. During tax season, we do free tax services for vets. So we're able to help them out with taxes. Legal services through Three Rivers. Our resume and interviewing skills, whether it's my staff, I've got 3.5 staff, 3.5 FTEs in there that help them, or whether it's Career Source. Transportation, work, and so we do bus passes. to help them get access to their work or to medical appointments. We provide clothing, tools that are not provided by the employer, and we do training. So I said forklift, security, and other training available based on their preference and their needs. And then the last slide really is, the other day, the state DOL Vets Director reached out to me and was really singing praises about our program. So I asked her, I said, can you put it in writing? And I said, so she did. And basically she said one of two things there. One, Jacksonville is the only government agency in the entire United States that has an HVRP program. The rest are nonprofits. Nonprofits run them very well. And also, in the whole Southeast region, we're the second rated as far as our success. I'm very proud. That's the staff. This has 3.5 staff busting their tails every single day. The other program that's better than us, Asheville, North Carolina, it's a nonprofit. It's a great group. I've been up there. They bought a hotel there on their property. So not only are they able to offer the employment services, but they're able to put people in housing that day because they've got the hotel they purchased. So, but again, partnership is the key to the answer. But we know very strongly that those that we'd be able to put in our program, those 333 veterans, are no longer homeless. They've got a job. They're self-supporting. So we know we're part of the answer. And I just want to make sure you all do that.
Thank you, Harrison. Before taking Harrison, I'd be glad to entertain some questions. If you wouldn't mind, move the microphone back over there and come back to your seat here. You can use your microphone here to answer. Any questions for Harrison or comments about his the work? I think there should be a great appreciation for the administration. And Harrison, how many years have you been doing this, Harrison? A lot.
I've been in the city 27, sir.
His passion for this work is unprecedented. It really is, and I want to thank him for that. Any questions for Harrison? Seeing none, Don, you want to go ahead and...
Yeah, and let me just check. Do we have comment cards? I forgot to ask.
Pastor Barlow was wanted to make a presentation. I don't know if that was part of comment, or you want to do that?
That's
separate. Okay.
All right.
Let him go first, I guess.
Yeah.
Alvin Lovington Barlow. It's my name. Before I say anything, I just want to, and I do thank you all of you all for what you're doing. I play good cop, bad cop. I know what motivates people. And so Dawn and I, we do radio shows together sometimes. So I told her last week, I said, look, I'm bad cop this week. I'm good cop this week. And I do thank the city of Jacksonville. I've been waiting on a meeting like this for a long time. I remember I had a meeting with Councilman Carlucci last year, but he was running for mayor and there was just so many conflicts, he really couldn't get it done. But he did call some people in the meeting from the mayor's office, and my lady asked me this question. I just want to share it with you. She asked me, she said, Pastor Barlow, what do you think the city's responsibility should be towards homeless people? Now, listen, that's a loaded question. I want to answer it publicly. In a traditional capitalistic society, the government shouldn't play at all in the private sector. Not in the business community, not in the homeless community. It shouldn't at all. But we don't live traditionally in a capitalistic society. We say that, but we don't. And we know that because our city gives corporate welfare to rich people to build up downtown. Okay? That's corporate welfare. So my answer to that question is the city shouldn't be giving money to anybody, especially not rich people. But if you want to give money to rich people, let's divide a portion of that to give to the poor. And I can show Dawn how she can get her $13 million. Let me show you how you can get it without raising taxes. Just Tuesday, a rev grant was given to a company. I passed it out to you. $5.3 million in a rev grant. Okay, now that's just one level. If you multiply 5% of that $5.3 million, that's a lot of money that can go towards homelessness. Jacksonville gave away at least $300 million in 21-22 fiscal year to private industry. Now, some of that was loans that had to be paid back, but some of that money was in grants and forgivable loans, basically welfare. I'm proposing that the city of Jacksonville set aside 5% of every grant and every forgivable loan to a company to redevelop downtown or whatever they give the money out for, and on top of that, to give 5% of every rev grant. That's going to do two things. Number one, it's going to provide some immediate funding for Dawn. If you look at
5% of $300 million, you get $15 million. That's a little bit more than what you're asking for that period of time. And that could be for 1 year. And when you're talking about REF grants on top of that, you're talking about a continual source of funding to do these kind of projects, everything that we need. And I want to say this right here. I help homeless people all over town, in Duval County, Clay County, haven't helped Indian-Nassau County yet. But it's way more homeless people than on the numbers that we're looking at. Because a lot of them are out by the airport, a lot of them are on Dunn Avenue, a lot of them are down Argyle Forest Boulevard, that's still in Jacksonville. But the downtown people get most of the care and concern and the calls and everything else. It's way more. That number could be twice what she's given us, to be honest with you. Let me show you what Orlando did, and that's what I was not surprised to see Orlando come up with Dr. Savage's presentation last week, because Orlando has what's called the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness. That's an organization that they got serious about homelessness a long time ago. And there's several cities in the metropolitan area of Orlando that got together and did this commission. And that's one of the reasons that their numbers are so low in comparison to ours, because they took this very, very seriously. And so the last thing I want to say is, again, without raising one tax dollar, I know the city of Jacksonville is going to continue to give money to rich people to redevelop downtown. That's a given. The Downtown Investment Authority, for lack of a better term, that is really a welfare system. That's what it is. It's organized welfare for corporations to continue to get money to redevelop downtown. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. The problem I have is that there's no requirement for those recipients to give some of that money back to the city of Jacksonville to pay for homelessness. How many homeless people we have in here? Just raise your hand. You're temporarily homeless. I try to bring as many with me as possible because I want you all to see the faces of the people that I serve. But there is a way to fund this, what we're talking about. You don't have to raise taxes. You don't even have to touch taxes. All we have to do is talk to the business community about doing right by the citizens of the city of Jacksonville. And I guarantee you won't receive as many calls. I have rapid pay. I pay some of these people to clean up lots around town just to keep them busy. There are many of them who I preach to every Sunday, unless I take a break like I did last week. But a lot of them work. They just don't make enough money to have. And by the way, you all have separated affordable housing from homelessness. Let's keep it that way. Because some of the language that we're using are interchangeable. And so some of the things when you're talking about affordable housing, that doesn't touch them at all. Those are two separate animals. And as soon as we get to separate them like some other cities like Orlando and Philadelphia have, we'll have better results. Now, is it time for me to speak on the car too?
Not yet. Gives you an opportunity to speak again. Just a couple of quick comments with respect to that. Number one, I thank you for starting that process. You've been chomping at the bit to share this, and I appreciate that. Just for the benefit of all concerned, the process was today was really kind of finishing up, understanding the dynamics of the process and what's available to us. Next meeting is all about what's happening around the country, the best practices that we could adopt, and then the final meeting will be about bringing recommendations such as Reverend Barlos, Pastor Barlos has brought us today, to the table as part of this process. Real quick on REV grants, just so I make clear, and I don't disagree with you at all with respect to the loans and the grants. You're absolutely correct. REV grant, if you take a look at the piece of paper, it's a $113 million investment on a piece of property that right now is generating zero taxes for the city. By this gentleman or this organization investing $113 million, they're going to get a 50% tax break on the newly appraised value of that property. So the city is going to see a much larger return than not. So it doesn't necessarily apply quite the same way as that. Not to mention the fact that 100% the authority taxes as well as the school tax, they're still paying 100% of that. So the incentive with REV grants really speaks differently than the loans and grants that you mentioned. But I don't disagree with your assessment of those. Thank you. Shannon.
Can I give one plug for next week's meeting? Because we've been set up perfectly. So next week's meeting, we're going to have three other communities that I invited for very specific reasons. One is Miami, who can talk about what can you do if you have a pretty much a guaranteed local revenue source. How does that make a difference? The second one is Atlanta. Atlanta has been extraordinarily successful in braiding bond money, public housing authority units, and state social services to accelerate permanent supportive housing in a way that is really not seen in other communities. The third one is Minneapolis, Hennepin County. We talk a lot about downtown and unsheltered. They had an extreme amount of unsheltered folks. And what have they done to start significantly turning the tide? And what worked there? So for next week, that we'll hear from each of them. You'll actually see Joe Savage again. He's going to moderate the discussion with the three of them. So not next week, thank goodness. 2 weeks from now will be that. So I get a week break on planning. The city council folks will be running the meeting, and I will get to be in the audience for next week. So Shannon.
Thank you, and I'm glad you're going to be hearing from those communities because they really have models that we should be looking at. I appreciate that you're going to be looking for examples from other communities. We don't need to reinvent any wheels in any way, shape, or form. People are very good at that. We need to tweak it to our local dynamics, but the solutions are out there. I do want to piggyback, though, and say, you know, what Central Florida was able to do, they went from one of the worst in the country with regards to how they deal with homelessness. They made, like, the top of the list for the coolest city on homelessness a while ago. In response to that, the mayors, the business leaders, the faith leaders all got together and created a tri-county commission on homelessness, recognizing that homeless people cross borders all the time. And it has really demonstrated what collaborative work together. And I hope that when we're looking at this, we're not just looking at what the government can do, although this is a city council committee, but also government's not going to solve this alone, nonprofits aren't going to solve this alone. We all collectively have to work together and looking at how we engage those other sectors for long-term strategies on how we hold each other accountable, because I think the timing on this is great. We've got to create what a former city council president called the sacred cow, the thing that outlives all administrations, each city council member. It just becomes the thing that we do so that we're continuing to make progress. And I just commend you guys and thank you so much for the work on this.
Amen.
Councilperson Salem.
Thank you, Dawn. I would be interested in where these $25 million are being spent today and what agencies, et cetera, because the example I would give you is our mental health offender program. We're diverting mental health arrest out of the jail, and the sheriff is supporting that program because we're taking people out of the jail. And if we can identify where these dollars are being spent now, they ought to be partners in this process. That's number one. Number two, do you have a feel for these 191 chronically homeless? How many of them have an opioid problem?
I do not, but it would probably be less than 15%. It's going to be higher than the general population average. Chronically homeless folks could have to meet that definition of disability, it can be a physical disability. It can be a mental disability, meaning, let me get it right, persistent.
Serious and persistent mental.
Thank you. it's a diagnosis. I cannot diagnose anyone, but it is severe and persistent mental disability. Or it can be a substance use disability that, again, rises to that level where it affects their ability to function.
But a small percentage.
A smaller percentage than we would think. When KO talked about the 100,000 Homes program, that was our first time as the nonprofit community. November of 2010, three mornings in a row, we went out 4 to 6 a.m. So a couple people were out there with us doing that. That opened our eyes to, like, what the spectrum of that was. I'm not saying it does not exist. Paul Stassi is here with City Rescue Mission. From his perspective, it's much higher because that's who walks through his door. What we're trying to do when we look at the whole population is, if you look at everybody, who's most acute and for what, and how do we tailor different programs to assist them?
The reason I say that is we've got dollars coming to the city through our opioid settlement program.
Resource, yeah.
and you know from the drug and the those dollars are very specific to what you can use them for, but I thought there might be some synergy here that
there absolutely is, and that is something if city council comes and says this, we want to look seriously at this. We can dive into these numbers, the people that are on that list. As Mr. Barlow said, there's probably more people out there. When we say by name list, we know who they are, so we can answer those types of questions for you. And we can look, because that is one of the things Atlanta did, right? If you're getting opioid settlement money and you know 20% of this 190 people meet that definition, can we put that money towards, can we carve out that amount and guarantee that funding for the 5 years for those folks? There's different ways to get to the full amount. I wanted to make sure that everyone, when we're talking about housing people, that was a great question you asked. Is there capacity in the system? No. If there was, I would not be spending the amount of time I have being at these meetings, prepping for these meetings, getting the information ready. What we need is to increase our capacity, and it is a community decision. There's limited resources. We all know that. Where are we going to target first? I propose this because these are the people that you are going to get the calls on. These are the people that are going to consume the most resources throughout our community. My thought is if we target the 20% of people who are chronically homeless, that frees up other services for the rest of the 80% that maybe never move up on our list, but still need services. They still need housing. They still need those other things. And Paul?
Thank you. Paul Stassi, City Rescue Commission. So I just want to make one thing clear about the question about capacity. I don't know, Don, if you're referring to housing, but the system also includes shelter care.
Mm-hmm.
And we have empty beds right now. So we're talking about individuals staying on the street. We have open beds. I know shelter care is not the answer, but it is a part of the answer in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot safer than spending the night on the street. So I just wanted to make that clarification that I don't really know offhand about other shelters here, but there are shelter beds available. And I think, too, we've talked about addiction. Over the last year, 100,000 Americans died of a drug overdose. That's like a small city. No, they were not homeless. But I want to make sure we're not negating the whole addiction issue, because it is a huge problem, and we're here to help, and our other agencies are here to help too. So we just have to remember addiction services are critical, whether it's inpatient or outpatient.
That would expand that to healthcare services as well, the third leg of the stool that we're doing in this project, because they're all interrelated, as Ms. Nasworth had pointed out. I'm going to go ahead and move on to public comment. We have two cards. Pastor Barlow, you were first, followed by, is Carnell still here? I don't see him. I think he left.
He left.
Okay.
Alvin Wellington Barlow, 625 West Union Street, representing the homeless. And it's fitting because I got a call from a homeless, formerly homeless person yesterday, who gave a one-way ticket back home. He wanted to go back home. He promised me that he was going to clean himself up and get off drugs, and called me yesterday, and I want to share with you what a sliver of what he authorized me to record, because I want to show you the human side of what we're dealing with. We're talking about dollars and cents and everything else, but there's a human aspect to everything that we're doing, and we call it human capital. If I can play this for you, so we don't have any difficulties.
It's by design, this room makes it very hard.
You've got a wall there.
it won't connect, but his name is Steve, and he called me. Here it is.
Steve got him on the phone, and I had given him, he was a homeless guy here in Jacksonville when I first met him.
You must have the same phone I do.
Telling him about the tents and everything, and he asked me for a one-way bus ticket back home, and I was able to bless him with that, and he's calling me to let me know how good he's doing, and I asked him if I could record his testimony and get ready to run it down to me. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, again, Pat Barlow was a great blessing God sent to you, and his help was, man, was needed because I wasn't living the life that God intended for me. I told Pastor Barlow, I'm a young man who lost his mother. He's 6 years old, watched out for AIDS virus. You know, my sister had my niece when I was 8. She passed away when I was 9. From a birth defect, I'm an infected woman of children. I got put in foster care when I was 12, my older brother. 15, my sister was murdered. 16, my uncle passed away. At 17, the only family I ever really had was my brother. He took his life. I got hit by a car in 2013, 160 miles an hour, I was walking. And from that point on, I've had 17 surgeries. If you would look at me, you would be able to tell it. If you would look at me, you would be able to know the trauma I've been through. I'm not talking about the neglect and poverty I grew up in, the abuse or anything of that nature. I'm talking about the person that you see, you know, when you judge that book by the cover, you don't know what that person's been through. And man, give glory to God that He allowed me to be Pastor Barlow. His works, you know, faith without works is nothing, but Pastor Barlow really put the work in. He really helped me out, and he gave me a chance, he gave me an opportunity when I didn't see what. So I'm very grateful, very blessed, man, that Pastor Barlow, and I call him again, you know, thank him because I'm clean. I came home, I told him, I said, Pastor Barlow, I'm trying to get a ticket to get home so I can get my life together, man. I said, I'm not meant to be doing this. I'm meant to be a father, man. That's the only person that I want to be. It's a great father, so I cleaned myself up. I came home, you know, went to a detox program. And now I'm in a sober living house, and I just give glory to God. I truly do.
Amen.
I'm going to end with this right here. You can't make a person be clean if they don't want to be clean. You can't make a person obey a law. We have laws against murder. People still killing each other today. So these people are human, and I don't expect us to treat them any differently than we treat ourselves. We can make the services available to them. We can encourage them. I preach to them, try to get them cleaned up, but they have to exercise their free will to do it. Amen?
Amen. Well, one thing I heard in that voice is what Mr. Conyers said early on. I heard dignity in his voice. He regained that in that process. And I want to thank all of you for taking the time to be here today. I know it's important, and I know it seems like we move gracefully, and in fact we do. But we are moving, and we recognize, as I said early on in this process, this isn't going to go away. We have to address it. We've got to be focused on it. It needs to be sustainable and continuing as we go through that process. I'm stealing the thunder from my co-chair here, Councilman Nick Holland. Nick, did you want to jump in at this point?
Yeah, thanks, Councilmember Boylan. It's been another fantastic meeting. I want to commend Dawn for putting together Ms. Campbell's presentation and inviting her here. And I'm such a data hound. It's great seeing the data that she's able to present. And also commend Harrison and the entire MAV department for the amazing work that they're doing for veterans. It's clear we have a long road ahead of us because we won't be happy until we end homelessness in Jacksonville, Florida. That's our goal. But this meeting served its purpose. Again, I think it was a great one. I apologize I couldn't be there, but the content was spectacular. So thanks, everybody.
And I hope you feel better. I think we mentioned this at the access to health care. We need a target number, an attainable number. And I think what you brought to us today is that very thing. As Ms. Gilman mentioned, next week we're going to end. The focus of the next meeting is, again, on some of the best practices. We're going to hear from three of them. But if there are others that you are intimately familiar with, please share them with the co-chairs so that we can fit them into the agenda for you to make a presentation or talk about some of the other programs that are happening that you may be familiar with as well. And with that, thank you, Ms. Gilman. Thank you, Mr. Conyers, for your time. And thank you all for taking the time to be here today. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you all.